This is The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of the monthly and the Saturday paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free superfund, Future Super. The Saturday paper's the source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and the monthly is the country's best magazine of politics, culture, and ideas.
Hi, I'm Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. Welcome to The Lucky Country. Every state has some form of corruption watchdog. In New South Wales, it's called ICAC, the Independent Commission Against Corruption. But while every state's got their own name for their watchdog, no state believes they don't need one. But that's not the case for our federal parliament. Despite the fact that our federal government spends more than $460 billion each year, there is no broad-based anti-corruption body at the national level. It's as if corruption magically stops at the border of the ACT. Now, as a proud Canberran, I think that's nice. But as a cynical economist, I think it's a bit naive. But hopefully things might change soon. For the last few years, the Australia Institute has been calling not just for a federal corruption watchdog, but for one with real teeth. For such bodies to be effective, they have to have broad powers to investigate all sorts of corruption. They have to have the ability to hold public inquiries, and they need a big enough budget to chase as many leads as they see fit. There's overwhelming public support for such a federal watchdog, and a wide range of former politicians, judges, and academics all think we need one. The Greens, the crossbench, and now the Labor Party are all starting to talk about the importance of a federal corruption watchdog, but the government is yet to say whether it will support one or not. It's no surprise that there's widespread public support for a federal corruption watchdog. It makes a lot of different people happy for lots of different reasons. Firstly, it can help restore our faith in democracy. At the moment, politicians accuse each other of being corrupt all the time, and the public never gets to hear what comes next. It's easy to throw the accusation, but with no body to investigate such claims, no one's ever exonerated, and no one's sent to jail. The result is the public hears a lot of accusations, and it doesn't see the result of many investigations. If we want to restore faith in democracy, we need a broad-based corruption watchdog to investigate all such allegations. In fact, it would even be good for those who were accused of it. At least they could have their name cleared. A federal corruption watchdog is also good for the economy. We hear a lot about the need to attract foreign investment. Indeed, we're willing to spend $65 billion in cutting taxes to attract foreign investment. But there's plenty of evidence that a reason that companies don't like to invest overseas is they fear that other countries are corrupt. It's in Australia's economic interest to have a federal corruption watchdog. It's a cheap way to assure foreign investors that their money is safely invested here in Australia. And then there's just good old-fashioned law and order. No one likes to think that politicians, public servants, or anyone is getting rich breaking the law in Australia. The only real reason to not have a federal corruption watchdog is that you don't believe there's any corruption in Canberra, or you think it's a waste of money. But given the government spends $460 billion a year, the cost of an anti-corruption watchdog would be a small price to pay, even if it never found any corruption. I think it would be a small price to pay for a lot of peace of mind. My next guest is former New South Wales Premier and New South Wales Senator, Christina Keneally. Christina, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country. What's it like joining the ranks of the federal parliament?
Well, in many ways, it's like riding a bicycle. Parliamentary life is very familiar, and there's a sense of almost bodily recognition of the familiarity when you go back into a parliamentary process and setting. But then again, the debates and the issues are very different. State politics is all about service delivery. And whoever's in government, those services still have to be delivered. You know, police need to go to work, hospitals need to be open, schools need to teach. I think the big difference at a federal level is that the debates you have are far more about your values, the values you hold as a party, and how those affect the broad range of decisions that federal government governments make. Federal governments don't deliver services, but they make decisions that regulate, shape, and speak to our identity as a nation. So regulate the businesses, regulate the services, you shape the way we frame the economy or frame our foreign policy, frame our identity, frame who we are as a nation. Quite an interesting difference when it comes to how you approach media, how you approach legislation, how you approach debates.
That's really interesting, especially when progressives are mounting campaigns for things, that there's a class warfare or culture war. But it sounds to me like you're saying federal parliament has quite a lot to do with culture and identity. Is that how you see it?
Well, I think our federal parliament is one of the key institutions that helps define who we are as a nation, how we shape our society and our community, and how we represent ourselves to the world. And it is about who our identity, that is about the culture. I mean, culture, being Australian, what it means to be Australian, how we live that out in our interactions with one another, in our interactions with the world, is fundamental to the work of the federal parliament.
So given that federal parliament is a collective manifestation of our nationhood, should we be worried about corruption in our parliament? Do we need a federal corruption watchdog?
Well, we should always, at every level, but particularly in our governments, be concerned that people are acting ethically, that they're there with the highest integrity, and that they're serving the sacred trust, that is the trust of the people who have elected them. And, you know, I say at every level, businesses should be held to similar standards, but I do think in governments where we are dealing with taxpayer money, where we are dealing with the trust of an electorate that voted us there, and when we are making decisions for the common good, for the good of the community, that a commitment to integrity, a commitment to ethical behavior needs to go beyond just people saying that they hold that. We need to demonstrate both in our proactive work that we do, that is, you know, corruption proofing, ethical training, advice and resistance that we build into decision-making processes, but also investigative abilities to ensure that nobody is above the law, no branch of government is above the law, and that that people can have confidence, people in the community can have confidence in the decisions that are taken by the government in their name.
Critics of the need for a federal corruption watchdog either suggest there's no real corruption in Canberra or that the creation of a new body would be a waste of money. As the former Premier of a state that has a corruption watchdog, do you think the existence of the New South Wales ICAC had an impact on the way politicians and public servants behaved?
Oh, absolutely, and fundamentally so. ICAC in New South Wales has, you know, undertaken some fairly significant work in both the terms of examining Labor and Liberal politicians and exposing corrupt conduct. It is a fundamentally important part of ensuring that we are demonstrating and modeling and striving for ethical and behavior amongst our politicians. But I wonder about this claim that there's no corruption in our federal parliament, and that it's almost as if, well, the things that we've seen at state levels in various states across Australia, somehow that behavior stops when you hit the border of Canberra. I find it hard to believe that in the years since Federation, there's been no corruption within our federal system. And that's because I'm not naive that about this, that there are people, there are a very small number of them, who do, over the course of their career, make a number of small decisions that lead them to very big and corrupt places. And, you know, that is, we've seen that across Australia in governments of both stripes in many jurisdictions. And while I don't know of any specific corrupt behavior in Canberra, of course, if I did, I'd report it to whatever authorities I could. I do think that it's an essential element to democracy that we're able to both advise, help strengthen, proactively prevent corruption, which is something I see a national integrity body being able to do, but also to investigate allegations of corruption and bring them to exposure, put sunlight upon them. Sunlight is the effective disinfectant when it comes to exposing and ridding a government process or decision-making process or system from corruption.
We're certainly seeing at the moment that a bit of sunlight in the banking industry is showing us some problems that we were assured weren't there. Do you think it's harder for the government to suggest we don't need a corruption watchdog when they spent so many years assuring us we didn't need a banking royal commission?
I think you make an excellent point there. Claims that there is nothing untoward happening tend to crumble when we shine a light on where there are concerns or allegations of serious and systemic behavior. And we've seen it with the Banking Royal Commission. We saw it quite stark and tragic terms when it came to institutional responses to institutional sexual abuse. I would like to think that a national integrity body at a federal level ends up investigating not very many things. But I think those who oppose a national integrity body and think that it's only about investigating miss a fundamental point. And that is, these bodies, when constituted well, can also serve as a corruption-resistant organization. That is, that they can help our decision-making processes, they can help individual politicians, they can help bureaucrats, learn to recognize corrupting situations, learn to resist them, learn to uphold integrity in government processes. It's as much about prevention as it is about investigation.
Just finally, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that people are losing faith in democracy. The number of informal votes is rising, and opinion polls keep telling us that people have become more and more cynical. Obviously, introducing some sort of corruption or integrity body wouldn't help address some of these concerns. But as a former Premier, what else do you think we can do to help restore a bit of faith in our democratic structures?
Want to ensure that we uphold and value the democracy that we enjoy in Australia. And we only need to look around the world to see the erosion in some of the institutions that have helped strengthen democracy. A free press, a robust and trusted media, the ability for people to rely on the information that they're receiving. And in that sense, I worry about the ability for people now to be presented with information that only conforms to their already held views, to not be challenged, to only speak to people who appear or do hold their same views. And one of the things I often encourage young people to do is to make sure that they read widely, a wide range of media organizations, that they find ways to engage in conversations with people they don't agree with, not in a belittling fashion, not in a winner-takes-all approach, but to somehow find ways in their interactions with people to restore civility, openness, and the ability to interact with one another with the aspect of learning from one another and building connections rather than dividing into blue state, red state, this corner, that corner. And I do see social media as having a great role to play in allowing a wider range of voices to be heard.
Don't forget podcasts.
And podcasts. Absolutely. But I do think it presents a challenge that we are working our way through right now in terms of what information can we trust and how do we ensure that we are not increasingly isolated from information that might challenge us or opinions that we don't agree with.
In some ways, it's harder and harder for people to find common ground. But at the same time, there are more and more opportunities for people to do that if they wish. In fact, when you were on Sky News, you had a segment with Peter Credlin. What was that like?
It was fantastic in the sense that, every week I got to go head-to-head with someone who had very different ideological worldview to me. but in a respectful way. And the viewers actually responded to that, I think, quite interestingly, maybe because it was two women, maybe because it was something they hadn't seen before, two women from two completely different points of view, talking issues through, and I'd like to see a bit more of that. I think the idea that conflict, as I said, red versus blue, your corner, my corner, and we duke it out, it's spectator, it's entertainment, but it doesn't actually advance much. And I would like to see more conversation from respectful different points of view, rather than just let me try to win the grab war or win the one-liner war because it makes good sport on television.
It seems these days we often confuse disagreement with conflict, and of course democracy requires a bit of both. But if we can't talk about our disagreements, we're not going to be able to fix much.
Well, you only need to look at what's happened in the United States under the Obama presidency. The Republicans there in Congress took an increasing view that, they would oppose things just because Obama supported them, which, having grown up in the United States, in Reagan's America, there was a lot more bipartisanship. There was a lot more reaching across the aisle. There was a lot more shared commitment to getting things done than you see in Congress today. And you look at the American Congress, you look at its approval rating amongst the community, it's at, single digits. And I think that speaks to the fact, and I think it speaks to a lot of the dissatisfaction we see here in Australia, is people are sometimes just of the view that politicians are interested in the arguing and the scoring points rather than getting things done. And, that is the challenge for all of us who go into politics with an aim to build a better world based on our worldview and our values, to find ways to reach across and work with people who may not be of our party, but we can find enough common ground to build a better Australia.
Christina Keneally, thanks so much for joining us on The Lucky Country.
My pleasure.
That was Christina Keneally, former New South Wales Premier and Senator for New South Wales. So the experts, the academics, and even some of the politicians think we need a federal corruption watchdog. Jolene Laverty went to see if it passes the pub test as well.
Do you think we need a federal ICAC?
Yes, I do think that, because I think it would be really good to have accountability in higher levels of government. And I think that would be a way of facilitating that.
Do you think we need a federal ICAC?
I do, actually. I think that, it'd be pretty critical, though, who is a part of this body. But I think at the end of the day, what it would do is make governments more accountable for their actions and create greater transparency and then in turn better communication between citizens and the government. So I don't see what the problem is.
Well, I wouldn't have thought so until the Royal Commission into Banking showed us that the extent to which powerful organisations can hide what they're doing and can hide the injustice and the malfeasance that they perpetrate behind veils of secrecy. All that shows us that we do need an investigative body with a lot of power to ask very difficult questions of powerful organisations and people.
This week we welcome back Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment. Chris is a Canberra-based lobbyist who's widely seen as being pretty much to the right of me, but despite that, we seem to have plenty to talk about. Chris, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Thank you for having me here again, Richard.
So, is it a left-wing thing or a right-wing thing to want to treat animals well when we export them from Australia?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
There's always a first. It's a very difficult question to answer. I've been pondering it, as have you. I think this is one of those things. I think it's a bit like euthanasia or something like that. It cuts across people's party lines. It cuts across their philosophy. People love animals or they don't care, would be my way of putting it. But most people don't care, I think, because they've never been actually confronted by some sickening things. And To their credit, the Four Corners and the activists and whomever gave them that footage have highlighted something there where most people, even the National Party people to some extent, have sort of gone, hang on a bit, this is way beyond the pale. And it's not, and to them, it's obvious that it just can't be business as usual.
Well, that's one of the interesting things, really, isn't it? That you've got a lot of farmers, who, you know, whose job it is to breed animals that will be killed. Well, a lot of farmers really care about the animals, and I think the political disruption here seems to come in part from the fact that a lot of farmers, a lot of people in the National Party are simply appalled at seeing the way their animals are being treated.
Well, I think that's right. And it's one of those things, if I could dump cultural relativism for a sec. Australian shippers, and there aren't very many of them, unfortunately, would not do this. Mm. Well, at least we would think they would not do this. This is one of the troubles in the sort of laissez-faire system where Middle Eastern shippers don't give a hoot. And they're the ones who've been the bad stewards in this space. And our values, you know, don't actually coincide with theirs in this case. And that's why they've let this happen. And that's why our system has uncovered it. So I'm not advocating that we introduce a new shipping line. That would be silly. But equally, I'm particularly open to the idea of ceasing the trade.
And I guess that's what surprised a lot of people, that you've now got farmers and indeed parts of the National Party saying, what are we ruining our whole industry's reputation for a live animal export industry that's not really a large part of the total size of the industry?
No, look, I agree. I haven't looked at the economics of it, but I know some of the people involved in it very well. I have a very high regard for them. And where the public debate's going very fast to me is very clever. The footage was of sheep. Sheep are the low value. It's a cruel thing to say, but it's true. The low value bit of this trade. There's shocking evidence of maltreatment, whether deliberate or negligent or whatever. It's still very bad. That comes from southern Australia, the flock. So if we were to ban this trade, or to make it so regulated that it would cease for economic reasons. What is the terrible fate that would befall the farmers, according to the naysayers? And the answer is there'd be more lamb sold on the Australian domestic market.
At lower prices.
One would suggest it would put the price of food down in Australia.
How Aussie's that?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if Sam Pekovich is around, but I think that's a cost that we can all bear.
I'm willing to make the sacrifice.
Exactly. Slow cooked or not. And so it's a very clever reaction to a difficult problem. The earlier issue was about northern cattle, and the simple fact is there's not enough people who live there to have the abattoirs and stuff like that to make it a transition there very simple. But this is a pretty good start, and I actually think it's one of those things where, back to my point from an earlier episode about the media and sensationalism always diminishing politics, this is a great example of where, even with our strong party system, various people in the government have just said, I don't care what our view is or is going to be. I'm a member of parliament. I'm going to bring a bill into the parliament to change this in whatever way they want to, and I'm going to get support across party lines to do it. It happens more than people realise, and it's a good thing.
Well, and also it's an interesting example where the rhetoric about free trade versus regulation, red tape, nanny statism's completely collapsed. Everyone's talking about what's the best way to regulate trade in regards to live exports. You don't really hear even David Lionhelm speaking out in a loud anti-regulation libertarian rant. What's going on?
Well, I think the facts are coming home to roost.
Have they been slaughtered on the way back?
Yeah, sorry, that was extremely bad mixed metaphor. Some things are just obvious, and this one is like that. Like, what is the point in torturing an animal? And most people would not ever do that, let alone condone it, in order to have it murdered in 3 months or however long it takes to go across the sea. If it's going to be murdered, let's murder it humanely now. And if there is a replacement trade from another country, so be it. And in my view, I don't know which countries we're talking about here, but in those countries, the population there would probably have the same view as most people do in Australia. And if the conditions were as bad as some of these are, highlighting that would probably interfere with that trade as well.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The Lucky Country. The Lucky Country is brought to you by Schwartz Media and Future Super, Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund.